So now it's all about the evaluation strategies themselves instead of just proving whether there can be an evaluation strategy or not. So there's several approaches to this. For once, there's of course the approach of, well, not providing any means at all, but instead let the user define how to evaluate attribute systems. So you have to go all the way by foot as a user, and you might also break a leg during that. Then there's the other approach of setting up automatic strategies based on the concrete dependencies that you find within your attribute systems. For that, you can also go several ways. One way would, for example, be to compute the attributes by need, so to say. So we would have to fix a certain attribute for which we are interested in its evaluation. In the example here, we would, for example, decide to not in sync with the example. We would decide that we would like be interested in the N attribute of the child. So for that, we would start computation, and dependency graphs shows us that we, for evaluating attribute N of E, we need to, for once, require the N attribute of the root node here, and also the F attribute of the edge over here. So, yeah, you would then recursively trigger the evaluation of these nodes, which would then evaluate, look at their dependency graphs and decide for evaluation of that, we need this and this and this, and so on. You would propagate through the whole tree until you reach the leaves, and you will at some point reach a leaf because there's no cycles in these systems. And then when you reach a particular node where there's nothing else to compute anymore, you would then start to compute these actual values and go back to the dependent equalities, evaluate them, get a new value for the next attribute, and so on, and the cascade would fold again until you reach the final value that you want to evaluate. The other way to go would be to compute your attributes in passes, which means that you could, for example, go such a way that you would compute a dependency graph between the attributes, at least if that is somehow possible, and then traverse the syntax tree for each attribute which doesn't have any further dependencies. In our example here, we would, for example, first start with evaluating the E attribute of the tree, then we would continue with evaluating F, and then next we would evaluate N. So that's your empty first next, for example, here. And yeah, with that you would make sure that in each pass through the syntax tree you would at least compute one attribute. The third possibility then would be not to fix a certain attribute in a specific node or a complete set of attributes, but instead you would fix the strategy with which you would go through the tree, and then allow only the evaluation of attribute systems that can actually be evaluated with that strategy and compute that. And in case you still have dependencies open and still have attributes that you actually wanted to be evaluated, reiterate this whole system and again perform this fixed strategy with the data that you have computed in the last pass still distributed throughout the system, and by that step by step complete your set of evaluated attributes until you at some point reach a completely evaluated attribute system. You're looking quite dazzled there. Yeah, that works. Yeah. Exactly. So that would be the idea. So you have to make sure that there is such progress. So more details about the two automatic versions is the demand-driven evaluation. We have seen the example already. We start with the evaluation of the required attribute, and you recursively descend through your tree. You can do that with recursive calls, for example. That would be a possibility. However, you might have to somehow implement means of accessing the parent from a child if you do so, because you might have to go back up somewhere in the root direction. And then the other automatic strategy would be to do your evaluation in passes. You would pre-compute a global strategy which you would like to apply to visit as much nodes together as possible. And if you take into account that there's also local strategies for evaluation within each of these subtrees, you quickly come to a point where you can't say per se which of these things, which of the strategies are beneficial to you, but instead you would come to a point where you would have to minimize the number of visits that you pay for each of these subtrees. And yeah, the whole thing soon turns into a kind of an optimization problem, which you have to solve. Let's have an example for demand-driven evaluation. That's once again the running example from the beginning with the first, next, and empty computation. So imagine, for example, that you would be interested in the next leaves of A2, A3, and B4, which is this one, and this one. The way that you would go would be you would pick a particular attribute instance, for instance, B4, and try to follow the dependencies which are based on the equality systems. So that would be an occurrence within the attribute equalities of the OR node. In there, we would read that next of 2 is just next of 0, so we would have to evaluate for this next attribute, we would have to evaluate the next attribute of this one. For that, we would have concatenation. Concatenation says for next of the second child, we have to go to next of the root. So we do so. And then, once again, there's concatenation. So we use, once again, this one, and this will give us next evaluation, and for the root node we have a fixed value of empty, and then we can take this value and put it into the attribute for the root. So we have an evaluation of that attribute available, so the depending attribute can be computed. So the blue one also gets empty set, then it's evaluated, we can evaluate the next one, and so on. And same goes for the other next attribute. If we're now interested in, for let's say, the evaluation of A2, again and again and again, A2, then we come into a little bit more interesting things. We would, for this one, have to consider how to compute next for the left branch, and there's a lot of other attributes involved. However, you can do so by integrating the attribute equalities for the other attributes also in the system, and you end up with a few other dependencies that you that lead to evaluations during the tree. But yeah, you can just evaluate them in their according to their dependencies. So with that, you will get a part of the total of the syntax tree evaluated, all these things here, but there's still a lot of others around here missing. So you might save time with that approach, because you only have to evaluate a fraction of the attributes. However, there's a lot of cases where you are actually not particularly interested in only one attribute or a few of them, but typically you're interested in quite a lot of them or even all of them. So, that is up to a certain amount a quite clever idea to do it in a demand-driven way. However, you might not end up saving time, and also you might pay certain nodes a visit several times, one after each other, and have to navigate through all the nodes a lot. So this makes up quite a lot of noise in terms of performance. So all in all, this algorithm is something which is not very local. Instead, it's very distributed throughout the whole data structure and might need a lot of loading and throwing away of cache lines and all that. And that might be a crucial point in performance of your algorithm. So this one, for example, is not very local. Also, you might have to pay nodes a visit very more often than necessary, and that's not what you actually want. So the other thing that you buy into if you pursue the way of demand-driven evaluation is if you have generated the whole system, you might be able to rely a lot on the things that are going on in there. If you have created such a system in a manual way, then in case you're still developing the whole thing and you need to debug your system, an algorithm that's not local, which jumps around a lot in throughout your data structure, creates a lot of actions throughout the thing and might turn out to be a hassle to debug. So that might be an issue for you, difficulties in debugging. And yeah, the other thing is that most requirements, at least the ones that I'm aware of with a certain connection to compiler construction, say that, well, you need the attributes for all the nodes anyway at some point, because you might access a certain attribute throughout code generation or type verification, and you're gonna perform these kinds of actions on the complete syntax tree anyway, and you might want to access these informations then from every node, and thus you need all these attributes to be evaluated anyway. So you might benefit from the fact that you can, while you're already within a certain node, you try to evaluate as much of the attributes that are actually possible. So that might be cheaper for you. So the idea would be not to perform demand-driven evaluation, but instead go over to perform evaluation in passes, such that you get a certain profit from evaluating in the current node. For that, the basic idea would be not to only evaluate the absolute minimum for what is necessary for your current interest, but instead evaluate all the equations that are possible in the sense that if the arguments, which are also attributes, if they are also already evaluated, then it would be beneficial to also evaluate the attributes that are depending on the ones that are already evaluated, and so on, to the complete closure of the whole thing until you reach a point where you cannot evaluate any other attribute anymore. In case that you have beforehand already tried to establish whether the whole system is cycle-free or not, you have already computed certain attributes, like the over approximations of all the dependencies between the attributes of one type of the syntax tree, type of node of the syntax tree, and you have computed them in form of these variables R star belonging to the particular syntax tree node type. And if you look at a certain type of tree, which it relies to a certain production P, of course, and you can reuse the information that you have computed in the last phase with this R star things to get the over approximation of the dependencies of your subtree or equation system for a certain production, and take this as the source for coming up with an evaluation strategy for your automatic evaluation by trying to find the graph subgraph of this graph structure that will cover the most the most in this case leaves if you start from evaluated attributes that are still not evaluated right now. So you with this formula over there, what you refer to is actually the in a certain subtree all the dependencies that go round somehow in there, for example like this, and also going over to some other thing in here which will then go over there and so on, and you would try to use this graph to, given that a certain attribute is evaluated, for example, and try to find the subgraph of this thing which covers the most attributes that can be evaluated with following the dependencies from that graph. And that would be the evaluation strategy to go for that particular production. Of course, that is only a local strategy, and if you plug them together into their context, you might end up with certain necessities, especially if you, for example, see that there's recursion somewhere in your productions. For example, in such a situation, there you would somehow relate the evaluation of the attributes for a certain symbol, like the one on the left-hand side, to the evaluation of symbols of the same type, which can be found on the right-hand side, and you would the evaluation of all the attributes from this would somehow depend on the evaluation of certain attributes from this one, and these might not necessarily be the same attributes. So in order to minimize the number of visits that you have to pay to these subtrees, you would have to come up with an optimal strategy that also takes into account situations like these. Otherwise, you would have to go through the whole thing in several passes, and you see that with that you get into the territory of optimization problems quite fast, because you need to somehow weigh one interest against each other, either trying to evaluate as many attributes as possible in for one symbol, or try to come up with a way of evaluating so that you can descend through the whole tree and go back up without having to leave too many open attributes still in the subtree due to these connection issues. So that is a thing that I don't want to talk too much about right now, because that's completely different matter. You have to come up with constraints for the number of visits that you have to pay to each of these symbols, attributes, and for that you would have to compute an optimal strategy and then realize that as an evaluation in passes, but that's more of optimization problem and for such an a lecture. So more concretely in our example, what we found is that for example, if you do evaluation passes, you can evaluate empty and first together. However, for as next somehow relies on the presence of certain attributes like empty and first, although they are not evaluated yet, you have to be you have to compute the next attribute in a separate pass for that. So, well, a practical issue, if you're moving a little bit farther away from the theoretical problems that you get in there, is that of course this evaluation of attributes looks a lot like functional program. You can only access the information that you have in certain states. So you might wonder how you could come up with something that, for example, needs some kind of state. So I've got an example for state-based problem here. And the example actually is you would like to give numbers to the leaves of a syntax tree, for example. So that is the very first example that we had in our lecture. We wanted to give these numbers to the leaves. For that, you actually already need some concept of state, because when you reach, for example, that node, you need to be aware of that we have already somehow found our way to the other states, and you already need to know about the actual number of these states. And if you only have attribute systems, you might wonder how to realize that. And there's a kind of standard technique how to achieve that. And the technique is to somehow try to fit your needs into the runs downward in the tree, and separated from the needs of your run upwards back from the leaves up to the root. So you would introduce special purpose attributes as helpers for these aspects of a run through the evaluation of a attribute system, and you would use the pre-attributes to propagate in our case the value for the first leaf down into the tree. And in the post attribute, you would pass the value of the last leaf that you have visited back up to the root. For counting leaves, for example, you could do that in a way like this, where for the root, you would assume that for the aspect of going down and trying to find the first leaf of the tree, you would start without having found any leaves so far. So you would initialize your aspect of going down with the constant zero. And you would specify that you would propagate that attribute down by relating pre-1 to pre-0. Post is, well, for that purpose, it's just for completeness over here, but let's not waste too much energy on that. For general nodes, what you would do is you would propagate the state information from your current root down to your left child at first. Then what you do is, whenever you have finished counting all the leaves, or numbering all the leaves of your right child, you somehow need to take care of your left child. But the other way around, of course. If you have first covered your left branch, you now need to cover the right branch. And there needs to be a connection in terms of you need to communicate state between the left and the right branch, because you have to start numbering within your right branch with the next number that comes after the one with which you have stopped in the left branch. So you need to somehow propagate that, and you do that by relating the pre and post of the inner node to each other. So you would give the information from the post traversal information from the first child as the pre-traversal information to the second child. And in the end, if you have finished with all your children and all the branches, you would hand the post-traversal information of your right child back up to your current root node. So that's just managing the states in the middle, in the inner node. The thing that we have left away up to now is what you do at the leaves, and at the leaves you have the actual work to do. Here you have to somehow compute the numbers, and as soon as you give a new number to a new leaf, of course, you somehow modify the state that your current traversal is in with respect to numbering of leaves. So what you do is you take the value from pre-traversal, which is given to you by your pre-attribute, and increment by one, because you will consume kind of a number from your numbering pool, and give the new number back as your new state to the post-traversal information with that. So at the leaf, you will do another attribute assignment, and well, as a side effect, you might also just take this number away and put it into your leaf. But yeah, that's kind of the side effect of the whole thing. You can do that by just querying the pre-traversal value of your or the post-traversal value of your leaf anyway. Okay, so if you plug all that together, you get a system where you have which looks like this, where you always have these pre-attributes, and the pre-attributes always propagate to the bottom if they traverse levels during the tree. Then there might be a communication happening on the same level of the tree. In that case, we would communicate to the right. And as soon as we traverse levels once again, we can do propagation between the post-traversal attributes in the direction to the root. That is a system which doesn't have any cycles. It's even strongly acyclic. And yeah, that's what we have done with the pre-order, post-order, and inherited and synthetic. And we introduce a specific name for these types of attribute equations, which are the L-attributed grammars. And an attribute system is L-attributed if, for all its productions, every inherited attribute of SJ only depends on the attributes either of the particular current root of the subtree or the attributes to its left. So for an attribute of the node SJ, we either depend on the attribute of the root node S or of the attributes of the nodes S1 to SJ minus 1, which are all the nodes, if we talk about the this node over here, then it relies on the attributes of that node or that and that, depending on the nodes that might hang over there. So it's only the attributes to the left. So that is the L-attributed grammars. These grammars have interesting properties in the sense that they somehow are convenient for traversals of the tree, especially if you find yourself evaluating them during the run of an LL parser, for example, because such grammars actually exactly follow the way that you go through parsing your input anyway, because you actually do that in the same way as the traversal that's appropriate for the L-attributed grammar anyway. And so these are attribute grammars that are well-suited for evaluation already during the parsing of such an input. That might be interesting if you do something like side effects during parsing, where you somehow assemble statistics of your parsing run, or try to introduce meaningful gathering of error or diagnosis information or something like that. But there's also implementations where your parser just doesn't do generation for a generation of a syntax tree at all, but instead only relies on you trying to perform these L attributed grammar evaluations. And typical example for that would be your pocket calculator. I don't know whether that's something that's still used with smartphones all around, but maybe you know that from school. So you have these simple solar-powered calculators or so, and you had ways of evaluating expressions in there. And that would be, for example, something where this L-attributed grammar evaluation... Yeah, something like this. Pretty antique. Anyway, if you have evaluation of expressions on there, that could be implemented with L-attributes. I think there's even a tutorial exercise on implementing such a calculation scheme coming in the next sheets. So, yeah. The other attribute grammars are thus very strongly linked to a fixed evaluation strategy, a strategy of depth-first traversal from left to right. If you you shouldn't take the definition of L attribution as being the kind of condition under which your attribute systems only can be evaluated with a depth first traversal of your syntax tree. There's also there's a few fine-grained dependencies that we haven't put into the definition of L attribution here, because it might just make the whole definition quite longish and very ugly and very technical. But it's not a direct one-to-one correspondence. Yeah, there's also a few exceptions to this exact specification, which equality, attribute equalities can still be evaluated with a single depth first traversal. However, you can make sure that if you keep to the constraints from the attribute grammars, then you will be able to evaluate these systems in a depth first way. What you do if you can't press your attribute system into such a way, what you would do in general is you would try to partition the attributes into partitions or subsets of all your attributes try to evaluate as many of them in the same run, and just add another single depth first traversal to the end and try to evaluate the ones that are missing, such that you come to the technique that we have talked about before. You fix kind of your strategy in which you evaluate your attribute grammars and just iterate until you somehow find an end. Good. Practical applications for our principles is, well, what you can do with attribute grammars is you can do declaration use analysis. Again, declaration use analysis with symbol tables as the type for your attributes. You can perform type checking or even type inference on your expressions. You can do even code generation in form of L-attributed grammars by having your equation systems as concatenations on strings, for example, is the basic operation that you do there. or, well, doing some other string manipulation in there. Most of the applications, even all of the ones that are mentioned over there, are ones that just annotate the syntax tree with additional information each time that you run it on there. So they don't interfere too much, but may communicate in a read-only manner with each other. And that is, I think that's something that you already know so far. Maybe not directly. Well, in these practical systems, you have slight differences to the ones that we have seen in the theoretical part so far. You might have attributes only specific to certain types of nodes, and other types of nodes in your syntax tree might just not have the need of all of the attributes, so they concentrate on only the ones that are relevant for their particular use. For example, you might have nodes for statements or for expressions in your syntax tree, and if you consider the information, what is a valid identifier for that particular syntax tree node. If you look at expressions never produce any new identifiers. Instead, they just somehow make use of identifiers. You would have only one attribute, which would be an ingoing attribute, that would be able to receive information about valid identifiers. However, if you look at statements might not only be assignment statements or control structures, but for example, declaration statements. And these are statements that might introduce new valid identifiers into your current scope. So for statements, you would like to have two attributes, one receiving the so far valid identifiers and one communicating back from that subtree not only the ones that have been valid so far, but also the extension of all the new valid identifiers that are created if that statement is a declaration statement, for example. On even more practical terms is how would you, for example, proceed to create an attribute system in an object-oriented language? So for the purposes of our of our mini projects, for example, when you need to perform semantic analysis, you would, for example, do something like that. You would try to introduce the computation of attribute systems via visitors. A visitor would abstract away from a concrete run through would abstract from a traversal through your syntax tree, and carry the callback functions which are called at certain events during a traversal. And they function in a way that you would have, first of all, the classes that represent the syntax or parse tree. And I've put just one of the classes in here. For example, in our regular expression tree, you would have a class representing the generic node that might be in there, but you might also have a concrete version of an or expression, and expression, constant expression, or whatever can happen in there. And all of them would carry a method for accepting a certain visitor during traversal, and you would implement these accept methods in the concrete versions of your syntax tree nodes, For example, you would do it in the OR expression like this. And here you would implement the accept method and take as the parameter your visitor that carries your callback information, and then you would perform the depth first traversal in a chain of recursive accept calls. So you come in through the you come in through the header here with the exact like here, and you would within the definition of your ORX class, you would know that you would have two children, one to the left and one to the right. So what you would do is you would recursively call the accept first on your left child and then on your right child, and hand over the visitor that you got handed from somewhere above. And as the visitation of your particular node at that moment is already an event that might be interesting, you should also communicate that to the collection of callback methods, which just wait eagerly for something to happen. So you would do that in there. You would call on your visitor, the method depending on the actual instance of visitation here. For example, you would call the method pre when you're in the process of traversing down into the current subtree. So you do a pre-order computation with that. So you call this pre thing. If you come back up from the visitation of all the children, you call the post. And you might also be interested in the situation that you switch from your left branch to your right branch. So you might also introduce something like this inter callback. You can introduce these methods as you like, depending on the kinds of events that you're interested during the run. You just have to introduce them accordingly, and with that you get all your callback codes gathered in one particular class, or here in an interface, and there you can. There you can put all the code that's responsible to that particular traversal there. Yes, please?
I've got a syntactical question. What's the semantics of the default keyword in that context?
In the interface?
Yes.
That is a default method that doesn't help you too much, I think. That's something that you can now attach implementations to interfaces like this, and you have to announce that with the keyword default. Abstract doesn't have implementations, so if you have an abstract thing like this one, there's
provide some default implementations so that you don't necessarily have to implement.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes, please. Yeah, it's somehow related. That's a topic for the programming languages lecture, but it's not exactly traits, but it's quite close already. Yeah, you could also, if you just program with interfaces now and just don't touch any classes, then you are pretty close to the C++ multi-inheritance thing, because with the interfaces you have these several parents, and all of them can carry implementations right now, so you get pretty similar things. The only thing where it gets weird is as soon as you start mixing interfaces with classes, because there's a kind of hierarchy between the priority of the implementations that you inherit from classes and the ones to inherit from interfaces, the ones from classes always win. And even if you have abstract implementations, which is no implementation at all, that wins. So if a class with an abstract method F inherits from an interface I with a default implementation of F, in the resulting class, you will still have no implementation for that thing. Yeah, it's I said so. Yeah, so it looks a little bit strange. It's just a small patch that they introduced into the method resolution that made it possible to now have default implementations, but it brought you into that situation that you have this weird behavior of one overriding the other. It's, well, it's a patch that they did for something that worked already, and yeah, we're just not so lucky as to integrate it in a pleasant way, I guess, but yeah. Anyway, that's what the default is about. So this just makes it possible for you not to provide any implementation of these things at all. However, you can still override them to your own desire and, for example, perform the attribute computations as you would like them to be. So in an example, what would you do for performing leaf numbering for in our case? Well, what you could do is you could, yeah, there's now another layer. That's something that you find quite frequently when you have systems that rely heavily on these traversals of trees. You have an intermediate layer of another abstract class, which implements the visitor from before, so it still carries callback code. And this one serves just one purpose. It tries to introduce kind of catch-all callbacks for similar events. For example, all the post-traversal callbacks of the visitor in that case gather in just one callback. So all of them just all of them go to just this thing. So with that you can kind of save yourself from doing copy and paste, but just write everything to the same thing. And only if you want to that comes handy if you have attribute equations which act similar on almost all the node types, but just not for this particular one. If that is the case, such implementations like this abstract visitor come in, into play, where you put your default behavior into the general PO. Yeah, I needed something which is different to POST, I guess. So you call it there, and you just specifically override exactly the one callback method that behaves differently to the rest. So yeah, that's that. So that is that specific layer. And in the end, we will do something like... Today is particularly bad for that. Okay, so... we have leaf numbering now, which is now a special abstract visitor for the whole system. And what we do here is we introduce now finally our attribute system as a hash map on, yeah, which maps regular expression subtrees to integers, which are then the leaf numbers. And yeah, what we do here is we put to each regular expression the integer, and what we do is if we look into the details here, for example, we do in here we do the callback for the actual leaf of the whole thing, which is the const class here, which is just constants, characters. And here we perform the actual numbering. What we do is we obtain the attribute from the constant and increase it by one. And in case of the binary expression, what we do is we, while doing the prerequisite, what we do is we communicate our current number to the left child by obtaining n's attribute, r's attribute, and give it to r.l, which is our left child. And in case we perform the, or we are at the state of transition between the left branch and the right branch, there we do this inner match. For that we have the in thing, and here what we do is we just make sure that the right branch gets the current value from the left branch attribute. And then we only have to perform the post-traversal callback, which works by putting the... is that actually right? This here adds the left and the right child's thing. I don't think that that's quite right. That's more of the implementation for the depth of a tree. So I would say, in principle, what you would do is you would just communicate the right node's information. So that probably has to go away. See, there's a problem with presenting code. You have to test it beforehand. Yeah, I admit I never did that. So, yeah, in that case, I think you should just communicate the right branch's information back up. Yeah. So that would be the way to program with attribute systems in a practical way. Let's have a look, at least for the last few minutes, at what declaration use analysis means. So that's about one of the applications of attribute grammars here, and it has a more concrete use for analysis of syntax files in here. So declaration use analysis. Let's have a look in that. So what we're talking about is a situation that we get, for example, in the following code fraction. So in here we have particularly names for variables, and in languages like C and other derivatives, you have to first of all perform a declaration statement where you introduce that particular identifier as a variable for the rest of that specific area of interest. And yeah, I already kind of described with area of interest a thing that is called the scope. So there's a certain area where this identifier is actually meaning something specific and is relatable to that particular introduction of the concept. This is a particular variable and needs a particular amount of space in memory of my current process. So that is what the declarations are all about, and it gets complicated by the fact that you can do something like change the visibility of certain declarations by just shadowing the value with another declaration that declares the same identifier that you have used before anew. And that is the situation that you have here. In another area of interest, so the first area of interest that we had was covering all the way from the declaration to there. And in there, for that area, we introduced the concept of the integer variable large A. And then came a certain other area, like this one here, where we once again introduced A as a concept, but in this case we introduced A as a variable of type double. So the thing with shadowing is now that if you refer to A like this over here, you have to make sure that you interpret this A as belonging to that particular declaration and not to this one, as well as you have to make sure that after you have left the area of the inner A, you once again have to refer to the original declaration of A in there. So that is something you have to do. And the thing is, from a point of view of a compiler, what you need to do is, in case you somehow want to create code or something, you want to access the binding of an A, which means the declaration that is bound or is meant to be bound to that particular occurrence of your identifier. So that's what's with binding analysis is meant. In general, what you would like to do is you would refer from the use of an identifier to its declaration. That's why I call it the declaration use analysis here. You want to do that because you need to know about the details of certain declarations. For example, you need to know about, for once, the data type that is associated with your particular instance of that identifier. Also, you might want you might be interested in the context in which this thing was declared. It makes a difference whether something is a global variable or whether something is a local variable, for example, or whether something is a member of a struct, or all of that is highly dependent on either the declaration or even the context of the declaration. So somehow linking a name to its declaration is a desired thing here. And yeah, scope is something that I have mentioned already. So there's the scope of the int A, there's also the scope of a double A here in that area, and it's always the area between the declaration and the end of the enclosing block in our case of C-like things. And administration of these identifiers is a little bit complicated, thus the chapter here about that. So we need that because when we run through the AST, building up the code in the end that we want to generate, we somehow need to translate the occurrence of an integer in some way of memory access. For that, we need to know about the details that are important to the storage of each of these things. So we need the declaration, we need for the type of the whole thing, and also for the kind of storage that we need for that is several storage classes. So that is all things that we need. And this opens a whole lot of different problems there. We somehow need some way of rapidly accessing information about a specific identifier, and in some other way we need to refer to the right declaration for that specific identifier. So there's two sub-problems here. For the rapid access, what we would like to have is some kind of a unique identifier in our case, probably an integer or something that we would work with instead of whole strings, because strings is fine for humans, but for dealing with them programmatically, that's kind of pretty tedious. So we would like to use integers as keys for data structures that keep book of our identifiers. And the other thing is we have to link the usage of a variable in terms of, well, the integer code, of course, to the declaration of that variable. So that is the other problem that we have to tackle. So for the for terms of rapid access, the idea would be to replace the actual strings that make up a certain identifier with the integers that we want to encode our strings with. So the idea would be to do that already during scanning. We just wouldn't communicate the concrete strings anymore with the following phases, but instead we would just have integers encoding a certain string in our token stream now. And for that, what we would do is we would introduce a method during scanning, which would actually perform that transfer thing with the index for identifier function we introduce over here. So what we would do is we would keep some kind of hash table here. This is a map from string to integers. Like that. Which would keep book of the numbers that we have already given to known identifiers. So the proceeding would be the following. We would scan through our whole input, and each string that we find, we would put into our map, and in case that the whole thing is unidentified, we would add this the tuple of string and its current number to the mapping, and then of course increase the number, or else we would just take the value that we find in the hash table as the number that we use for replacing the input string. For that, we somehow need to be able to hash strings in a convenient way. I don't know whether you've done so before, but it might be interesting to see how you can actually do that. For that, you need a hash function for strings, which is appropriate for our users. So for that, we would need a mapping from strings to a finite number of integers there, which is somehow cheap to compute and distributes the occurring words in some specific manner that we call equally over the indices 0 to m minus 1. So there's several uses, so several ideas for that. Particularly what you could do is you could just take the starting character of your string. Remember, strings are just sequences of characters. So what you can do is you can take the very first and the very last, or some other constant scheme of obtaining the certain key characters from this sequence and compute with them, the sum in this case, and make the number that comes from there compatible to our range by performing modular operation with m, and take that as the hash value. That seems pretty fast, quite cheap to compute. However, might not be a good idea for special cases. So there's also the longer version that you can do if you want to invest the effort to go through all the input characters of your strings. But as you scan them anyway, you already have invested so much time, so you can also perform the detailed hash computation. So what you do there is you add them and multiply with a certain prime until you reach the end of the string, and only then perform the mod operation, or might also do that in between. For some certain prime numbers, that's also a good idea. So that would be valid choices for hashes, for example.
Why is the multiplication done in this case and not in the first case?
This one?
Yeah, because
this is the first case or this one?
Yeah, the H0 is the first case. And the second one, there's a multiplication done every step, right? So.
Yeah. For two values, I think it's still sufficient to just add one to another to get enough variation in there. As soon as you start to get longer strings and try to add all of them, for example, you get too much overlap and not an equal distribution. That is something that you try to obtain with this prime number. So you kind of simulate a very large number by taking P as the base of your numbering system and construct that very large number and only then perform the modulo operation in the end. So that would be the idea here. So that just makes a large number out of your string, which is a pretty common trick that you apply in these coding and decoding things. Yeah, in the end, you can't guarantee that the hash value that you compute with that is actually unique. However, that doesn't matter too much because you can implement your hash table in a way that you will not use a plain array of integers, but an array of lists where you store pairs of your particular string, as well as the unique integer that you want to give it, and just run through the remaining list with exact comparisons until you find the candidate that you have queried, or run out of list in case that you haven't stored a value for that particular string so far. And magically, that turns out that the axis and average is then just a constant for insert and lookup, which is quite fine for our purposes. So that is an easy way of getting a rapid way to associate our identifiers with some unique key, which we can use to within some other data structures. So there's an example for you. I'm pretty sure that each of you is is capable of performing this index for index for string routine yourself. So what you do is you pick your input and use each of these input tokens as input for the hash function, compute the hash function, and replace with a number in case that there's no entry there. You pick a fresh number and put a new entry in there, and so on. And if you do so, you come to an output like this, where you don't feature any concrete identifiers anymore, but instead you put unique numbers in there in case that your input is also unique. So Peter, Piper were the first two tokens. So in the output, you have also two different numbers. In case you repeat something, for example, the Peter is repeated over there, you will see that the zero is once again repeated, and Piper was also mentioned directly there, so you find over here. So that's the way that the whole system should work. So you get a mapping from names to unique numbers there, and for example, the hash table contents. So that's just for those who haven't done a hash table implementation themselves yet. So the other thing that we need to perform is refer the users to declarations to some point, and that's where symbol tables come from. I'm sorry, I have to go on a little bit because I think you'll need symbol tables for your next tutorial sheet. So it's just a few minutes left. It's not so complicated. So what you need to do is you need to check the correct usage of your variables in terms that you need to associate with the declarations. What you do for that is that you introduce these mappings of identifiers to their declarations. So I've done an example for you over here where I use stacks for each of the possible identifiers that we might encounter throughout our program, and in case that we hit redeclaration, we just push the location of the newly found thing onto our stacks. So we can do so like that. I've marked the locations in an abstract way in the comments. So V relates to A, W relates to B, X to this A, and so on. So if we look at our example here, what we do is we have to somehow enter that is to be associated with the symbol table that we use to keep book of the valid declaration usages of that specific position over here. So for A and B, we have to push the locations of their declarations. So for A, we have V, for example, and for B, we have W. So over here, we now pass a new declaration. So we still have V and W in there, but as we have hit a new declaration for A, we push its new locations on the stack from before, and C is something that we've never seen before, so we can just put its position in the so far empty stack. And now the declaration from here, this V is now has now this behavior that we call shadowed. It is now not at the top of the of its stack anymore, but somehow in there. And only when we pass the end of its scope, what we do is we remove all the things that we added in within that scope on the stack, and continue with the underlying things. Now we reintroduce C, but now at position Z, so we have to add Z like that until we then reach the end of the scope, where we have to do away with, well, the only thing that we've introduced in there is C, so we remove that to obtain this situation here. So that is, in principle, what you would do. The problem is now, yeah? That's what I wanted to terminate the sentence with. Exactly. So you need to somehow know about what you have to remove from the stack. So you would somehow need to keep book of the current declarations of scope, for example. You could enter that in, as an attribute of that specific representation in the syntax tree, for example. That would be a way to do it. But there's also other concepts in there. So, well, first of all, that is the outcome of what we would get in terms of syntax trees and attributes in there. And you don't have to look too detailed into that right now. The only thing that you should keep from that is that you would associate instances of certain names with declarations that have happened somehow before, and you do that by referring from one part of the syntax tree to the other. And that is something that you would like to do with attribute systems. You would want to have attributes with a type of symbol table, which you would then hand down to your left children, let them fill their respective parts in, patch it back to the to a situation where you but you can safely hand it over to your write partner. So in case that there has been some open scopes, you would need to close them, thus remove certain variables from there and give it to your write partner and then back up to your root. So that would be the idea of syntax tables in there. As it's quite problematic to remember what you actually have to remove from these stacks, there's this idea of having lists instead of stacks, where you would just introduce markers for the end for the beginning of a new scope, in the sense that that would be, for example, the content of the current list before you add before you reach a new scope, and then this is in that case it's marked with a color, but you would somehow introduce a canary or some other token in there which would mark that here is a new scope started, and you would then continue putting in the list the new declarations for certain things, and in case you hit a usage of some identifier, you would scan from the end of the list to the beginning and take the first thing that you find as your current declaration. And as soon as you hit a scope, you just search for the canary and throw away everything that, that's the else branch, but you throw away everything that doesn't belong, that has belonged to your so far opened scope and needs to be closed and put away. But instead of lists of symbols, it might be just more convenient to instead take complete hash tables to put in this list, in the sense that you could remove the uppermost hash table in case that you leave a scope and create a new one in case that you enter a new scope. And you can even go so far and use persistent data structures. You know them from the functional programming languages, but maybe also from certain libraries for your much-beloved high-level object-oriented language of choice. So these are structures which would be kind of read-only until you... and in case that you perform an update on this data structure, you get a new version of this whole thing, but still keep the old version intact. With that, you could, for example, that would be perfectly suitable for an attribute system. You would start with your initial version of your hash table, hand it down until it gets modified at some point, hand down the modified version throughout the scope, but when you leave the scope, take the persistent version from before and use that for advancing in your run through the whole system. And there's implementations of persistent data structures that reuse the fractions of the data structure that have not changed yet. So that is something which is even quite performing and memory efficient at the same time. So that would be perfectly suitable, the perfect tool for symbol tables here. So that would be the actual thing to go for. So now that we have reached 4 o'clock, I think we will finish with this slide here. I think you know the most crucial parts about the declaration use, analysis, and symbol tables. So, I wish you a nice next week, and see you all on Monday again.